While I was spending about 9 hours yesterday at Presbytery with other pastors and elders, during the course of the day, two different preachers mentioned that they essentially avoid the book of Revelation like the plague because it's so difficult. I didn't have the heart to mention that I was starting a study of that book today. I do agree that the book of Revelation is perhaps the most challenging book of the scriptures. I've managed to avoid it sometime myself. It must be challenging because there are more commentaries, there are more books written about the book of Revelation than any other book in the Bible. We may get frustrated with it, and yet we keep getting drawn to this book. It communicates to us, even when we can't understand the full significance of many of the details. The book is a letter to specific churches for use in all of the churches, just like all the epistles are. It's encased in a standard greeting and ending, like all the epistles. Apostle John has written several other letters, but this one is different. Doesn't sound like a letter. This one is written in a dramatic style that was popular in the first century, but which hasn't been used now in some 1,600 years. The Greek word translated revelation is the word apocalypsis, and it means an uncovering or a revelation of something. Books of visions were known as apocalyptic literature. How are we to understand the book of visions? There's nothing else like it. Well, we better start with John's introduction. Before we are allowed to see through the eyes of God, John says a few things about the ride we're about to take. Let's listen carefully, because we can use all the direction that we can get. Revelation chapter 1, first three verses.
The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw, that is, the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take it to heart what is written in it, because the time is near.
The first thing we learn about this book is that it is a revelation from God. Verse 1, revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants. And so what is true of all of the Bible is explicitly stated in this one book, because the whole Bible is God's special revelation to us. And there's a whole lot of things you can know about God just from looking at nature, just from looking at ourselves and each other, because we're in his image. But God is a person. And there's a whole lot we cannot know about him just by looking at what he made. And besides that, the image of God is somewhat twisted in us. So in order to know what God thinks and what he's doing in this world and how we fit into it, God has to tell us. He has to communicate his mind to us. He must reveal his inner thoughts. And that's what revelation is throughout the entire Bible, in fact. And our text also reminds us, something that we should know with every book, that the special revelation of God's mind comes through Jesus Christ, and it's about Jesus Christ. The words can mean either way. The revelation of Jesus Christ that God gave to him, that means it's a revelation that comes from Jesus. He's actually going to be speaking in the next couple of verses. It's also the revelation about Jesus Christ. In fact, it says the same kind of thing a little bit further on. It talks about the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. Once again, testimony about Jesus, testimony from Jesus, both being true. So this book is not really the revelation of John as much as it is the revelation of Jesus Christ. And verse 1 goes on to say that since Jesus is risen and he is alive in paradise, there has to be some visionary connection in order for him to speak to John. Verse 1 says that's established by angels. That's what angels do. So angels have somehow set up this connection between the risen Jesus and the Apostle John in order to communicate something special about God's mind, something we need to know. I think this is very remarkable that Jesus spent 3 years teaching John. He spent 3 years teaching the other apostles. This is besides all the inspiration given to the Old Testament. He spent 3 years with these men, with this man. And after his resurrection, he spent 40 days in this incredible seminar teaching them more after the resurrection. But he had to make personal contact one more time to emphasize something to John. What was it he felt so compelled to say? The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. John, my friend, one more thing. One more thing. I need to make sure you understand what is about to happen. Now, the way various interpreters take these words, what must soon take place, kind of illustrates their overall approach to the book. The overall approach isn't determined by these words, but it's a good place to stop for a second and review how people interpret the apocalypse. There are some large families of interpretations. The most popular view in America, of course, over the last turbulent century, takes this phrase, things which will soon take place, as concerning really mainly the first vision of the, to the churches. And the idea is that starting in chapter 4, and for the bulk of the book, the rest of it will deal with the time of Christ's second coming. They see the rest of that book as kind of a chronological prophecy of the very, very end of history. And these interpreters are called futurists. Futurists. Because they believe that almost everything in Revelation deals with events that are still future to us. And it's a very popular view when cultures are in turmoil, especially. And people really want, of course, they hope that this book will apply to them. And so futurists often try to find, they work hard to find relationships between what Revelation says and current world problems. In the 1930s, I have a book that proves that the Antichrist is Hitler. And then a couple of years, some years later in the Cold War, it was Russia and then China for a bit. Maybe now it's Muslims, I'm not sure. But in every age, good Christians who have this point of view really hope that this book applies to them. So they're going to be looking for ways to relate this to contemporary, politics and so on. Other good Christians will say that these words, what must soon take place, mean that all, or well, most anyway, of the book describes events which take place within a few years of the visions themselves. They would argue that the prophecies of Revelation deal mostly with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the fall of Rome in the years that follow. And, there are lots of biblical prophecies that were fulfilled in events which are now long past to us. And similar, these interpreters, called preterists, believe that the visions of Revelation were future for John, but mostly fulfilled in the early days of the church. And the last main view that I'll mention is the idealist view, sometimes called the idealist view. The idealist view sees that in these visions you have principles or truths which are valid throughout the whole age of the church. It sees the same themes repeated over and over again with principles applicable to the first century, applicable to our own day, and applicable when Christ returns. And I'll just tell you up front, I take the idealist position. That's going to be a stretch for some of you, I guess. Though I have to tell you, over the years, I have found very, very helpful insights from both of the other camps. Because the idealist position, after all, believes that there are going to be applications to the first century, and there's tremendous insights that you can get from preterists who write. And of course, it's going to have applications at the end of the age and talks a lot about Christ's return, so futurists have made a lot of helpful insights too. But the idealist view emphasizes that there is meaning in this book for us, no matter when we are living. This book is not just for our ancestors in the first century, and this book is not just for the generation of Christ's return. Whenever you live between the cross and Christ's return, Revelation is for you. And the reason I'm an idealist is reflected in this introductory text too. It says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. And it's paired with a phrase in chapter 4, just after that first vision to the churches, where John's going to be told what must take place now after this. And there's a sense of immediacy, there's a sense of commencement, there's a sense that something is now beginning. These visions describe a time period that was just beginning in John's day. Now, it's very clear as you read through it that a lot of the imagery of the book of Revelation, its kind of ethos, is taken very much reminiscent of the Old Testament book of Daniel. Daniel prophesied about the coming of Messiah's kingdom as an event that would take place far in the future from his perspective. In Daniel's most remarkable vision, he sees his own Babylonian empire. Then he looks and he looks down to the kind of the corridors of history and he sees the rise of the Medes and the Persians. And then he looks down beyond that and he sees the rise of Alexander the Great. And then he looks down beyond that and he sees the rise of Rome. And then in the middle of the Roman Empire, he sees the coming of God's Messiah. And very dimly, he sees this period of history in which the Messiah's kingdom grows and grows and grows in the midst of Rome and its aftermath, getting stronger and stronger until one day the kingdom of this world is overcome climactically. And then in the book of Daniel, it says these visions are described as what will take place in the future. And at the end of the book, Daniel is told to close up and seal the words of this scroll until the time of the end. In other words, this is going to happen a long time from now. So you take the words, you put them in a scroll, you seal them up in a jar, because people are going to have to read this a long time from now. It's going to be a while. Now, the Apostle John is also about to prophesy about the rise of Messiah's kingdom. But whereas the kingdom was far in the future with Daniel, John begins as saying that now, as I write this, the rise of Messiah's kingdom is beginning to come to pass. What was distant from Daniel's perspective is now right at hand. The Medes and the Persians have come and they've gone. Alexander has come and he has gone. And here we are in the middle of the Roman Empire. And what Daniel saw from a distance is now going to soon take place. And at the very end of this book, of John's book, he's told, do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book, because the time is now near. Daniel sealed his. John, don't seal yours. The time is near. The rise of Christ's kingdom in the midst of the kingdoms of this world, which was briefly glimpsed in Daniel's vision, explodes in the visions of Revelation. The first vision of the seven churches lays out the main message of the book, which is to persevere and to overcome during this time of tribulation and trouble. Satan doesn't give up easily. And that was Christ's message to the church in John's day and his message to us. We're going to look at that next week. That is the last thing Jesus wanted to teach with his own lips before he took up the worldwide spread of the gospel in earnest. And the rest of the visions all explore this one theme through the eyes of God, the way he sees it. The perseverance and the success of Christ's church during this time of tribulation as the whole world suffers the birth pangs of the kingdom of God. Now, how do you go about studying a book like that? Well, the book of Revelation is written in an ancient dramatic style. Think of it, if you will, as a giant tapestry with dozens of unforgettable pictures that weave themselves onto your mind. One of the most famous historical tapestries is called the Bayeux Tapestry, purportedly woven by the wife of William the Conqueror. It was woven to commemorate the rise of a new cultural age when the Anglo-Saxons in England were displaced from power by the Normans from France. It's about 20 inches high and 230 feet long. That's about 3/4 of a football field. Just imagine that, if you would. On this tapestry are hundreds and hundreds of individual little pictures or images. There's images of horses. There's images of boats. There's images of fortresses. There's images of food. There's images of royalty. There are conversations depicted. There are battles. There is death. There are more battles. There's battles all over the place. And if you were doing nothing but to study all of these little tiny images separately, you would soon become hopelessly confused. I mean, if there was no organizing principle here, you could put those puzzle pieces together any way you wanted and tell any story you wanted. But the Bayeux Tapestry wasn't meant to tell your story. It was organized to tell the story of William the Conqueror, because this mass of images fit together into 35 panels or scenes distinct from one another. And these scenes depict various aspects of what went in to this huge change to Norman rule. You have the personal impact, for example, of William the Conqueror. You have one panel of him encouraging the troops. You have then another one that talks about the influence of the church, as you have Bishop Odo blessing William. You have another one that talks about political intrigue, the death of Edward in England, leaving a power vacuum. And then you've got another one about relationships, where on the right-hand side, you have Harold giving an oath of loyalty to William, which, of course, he later breaks. Then you have the role of military conquest. You've got building of boats. You've got crossing of channels until you finally come to the Battle of Hastings in 1066, one of the great battles of history, and the final flight of the defeated British. And you can look at it, and you can see the age of Anglo-Saxons giving way to the Normans in England. Now, there is nothing wrong with taking out your magnifying glass and going up real close and examining the individual images of the tapestry. It's a fascinating thing to do. People spend their whole lives doing it. You can study hundreds of tiny details for years and never exhaust it all. You can speculate about the dozens and dozens of fanciful animals that decorate the panels. And what is that kind of animal? And why was that there? And what was the message of putting that kind of a thing up there? Or you could ask detailed historical questions about the kinds of weapons that were used. And, you know, that must be an Anglo-Saxon axe. And how did that talk about the way they fought? But wouldn't it be a crying shame to get so taken up with all of those details, as interesting as they are, and miss the main point of the tapestry, which is the rising of a new age as King Harold falls to Duke William, the new king of England. And similarly, would it not be a shame for us to get so distracted with the 10 horns on the beast or the precise date that John wrote this, a detail which God did not think important enough to specify, that you miss the main point of the visions, which is the beginning of a new age as the ruler of this world falls to Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. Let's save a detailed analysis of each image in the book of Revelation for the rest of our lives. And let's begin together by simply looking at each scene to understand what these visions are basically about. Because this dramatic work is broken up into a number of scenes. And that becomes clear if you just think of it as a book of visions. You keep asking the question, what is God? What is John seeing? What is he seeing? And chapter 1, verse 12, it says, I looked around to see the voice that was speaking to me, and I turned, I saw. And then he tells you what he sees. And he sees a vision of Christ and golden lampstands. And this first vision of Christ is talking to seven churches. And that takes three chapters. And all of those words, that's all one scene. That's what he sees. And then in chapter 4, verse 1, it says, and I looked, and there before me was a door open in heaven. And the voice I heard speaking like the sound of a trumpet said, come on up here, I'll show you what has to take place after this. And I was in the Spirit. And there was a throne in heaven. And you have an entirely different vision. You have another scene. John is looking now at a throne. He's looking at a representation of creation. He sees a lamb. The lamb opens these seven seals, and all of that is part of one vision as we look at the trials of this life, as God sees the trials and how he preserves his people through them. And then in chapter 8, you say, when he opened the seventh seal, when that was done, and there was a little pause, I saw seven angels who stand before God. And now we have a different scene. You have seven trumpets, and you go through all of that, and you see the same trials of this age from a different light as warnings of God's judgment. And then God's temple was in heaven was opened, and I saw the Ark of the Covenant, and there were flashes of lightning and rumblings and thunder. And now John turns, and he looks at the Ark of the Covenant, and he sees now all the tribulations of this age as a great spiritual conflict involving the devil. Lots of images about that. I'm still studying the book. To the best of my understanding, I think there are about eight different scenes altogether. One scene from earth regarding the seven churches and another seven scenes from heaven. And each of these is like a panel in a tapestry. They each have a whole lot of detailed images, but as you look at the scene as a whole, you realize that each vision tells its own story. Each vision looks at the entire period of the last days from Christ's resurrection to his return. In a different light. It's not as if like vision 5 chronologically follows vision 4. I mean, one vision follows another, of course. You can't see everything at once. You see them one at a time. But each one of the visions describes different ways that God looks at the whole age. It's the way he sees spiritual conflict, the way he sees the church, the way he sees Christ's second coming. And you see those themes over and over again from different angles, the way God sees it. Now, you understand, if that's true, what this means. I mean, this is big. It means that the book of Revelation describes God's perspective on the world in which we live. And that's the point. What I'm suggesting to you is that this is not just about 70 AD. Yeah, it mentions 70 AD, things that happened. It's not just about that. And this is not just about the last few weeks before Jesus comes back. Yes, it's about that, but it's not just about that. This book is about us. It's about us. We are privileged to live in the age of history that was prophesied in the Old Testament. It is a dangerous, It is a difficult and it is a glorious age. The devil wants us to believe that this age is normal, that his rule is good, and the world will go on like this forever. And Jesus Christ came back to give us the book of Revelation to strip away that lie. He says, John, I want you to know that this world as it is in this age is neither normal nor good. Oh, but his rule, Jesus' rule is growing. It's growing right now. And it is worth any price we must pay to see it grow. Because his victory is certain. We're going to see that over and over again. His victory is certain. Jesus came back to show us the age in which we live through God's eyes. Because the way we look at it can be very discouraging. Seeing things not the way Satan would have them appear, but the way they really are. Did you know the church looks like a bride? Yeah, it does. That's how God sees it. Do you know that the worldly powers that be, what they look like? They look like a monster. If this is true, then as we take up this challenge of Revelation, there's a question that we have to answer. This is not rhetorical. I got to answer this question. I've been thinking about it for several months. You got to answer this question. It's a tough one. Do I really want to see through God's eyes? Do I really want to know God's perspective on my life and this world? Why is that a challenge? Because surely, surely his perspective will not be my perspective. Do I want to know that? I see things from a very limited vantage point, do I not? Do I know what motivates people in power? Do I know the kinds of temptations they face and how that's going to affect me? Do I want to know? I don't feel the love God has for you. All I have is my love for you. Do I really want the responsibility of knowing how God thinks about you? Whatever I find in Revelation, I can be sure that it is going to challenge the socks off me. At least some of it. Because my perspective isn't God's perspective. We're bound to be different. For my thoughts are not your thoughts. Neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. Can I handle this? Look, playing with the book of Revelation is just fun. Academically researching the book of Revelation is safe. I've done it for years. But our text says, blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy. And blessed are those who hear it and take it to heart what is written in it. Because the time is near. For John, the time was near. Friends, for us. For us, the time described in these pages is now. Have you ever read this book? Are you prepared to see in its pages now? That this describes the world in which you live and which your children are going to live until Christ returns? No wonder the book ends with, come, Lord Jesus. Is that the way you feel? You will if you look at this book. Christian, do you really want to take to heart what is written here? Are you willing to see this world as a battlefield broken in hideous rebellion? How is that going to square with the American dream? Do you really want to know? How is it going to square with your politics? How is it going to square with how you're preparing your children for life, the education you give them, the wisdom you impart to them, the skills you train them for survival? Are we going to be willing to look at some areas of our own government or even branches of the church and see the mark of the beast? Friends, are you willing to see yourself as a Christian and other Christians the way God does, recorded here? Oh, we're taught on every side that we're victims. We like to dwell on our sorrows, our bad breaks. We like to think that happiness is a purchase away or a relationship away. Are you willing to see yourself as already belonging to God, the most blessed people in a hurting world? Are you willing to believe that you are sealed from any real permanent harm. That God Almighty thinks of you as his bride, he'll protect you, and not even the devil can do you permanent harm. Are you willing to believe that your future is more glorious than your childish dreams of fame and fortune, and that the relationships you could taste right now in the church, if you wanted to, is greater than your most romantic fantasies? Dear ones, are you willing to take Satan seriously? To realize that a being more diabolical than our devilish cartoons is real, and he is far more powerful than the military or the CIA, and he hates every Christian. Oh, Christian, he hates you. And we don't live in an age in which his hatred is completely bound either. Oh, he is bound that he cannot stop the gospel. We're told that. But he can sure try. And he can make life very miserable for those who want to be faithful. That's why Jesus had to come back to John and said, John, you got to endure. You got to tell him to endure and be faithful. But Christian, are you willing? Are you willing to see Jesus differently too? You know, we learn a lot about Jesus from the Gospels. And so we see him as a humble carpenter with a healing touch and words of life. Maybe you imagine like I do, walking alongside of him, this sandal-clad figure and his arms around us, you know. And such a vision of Christ is so appropriate. It's so good. But it's not complete. In The Lord of the Rings, there's this character called Strider. He's a ranger, kind of a frontiersman. And as the story progresses, you finally get the picture that this is Aragorn, the rightful king. And at the end of this story, he's no ranger. He's robed. He is crowned in kingly glory. And the ones who used to walk alongside of him, somehow they kind of feel the need to bow. In seminary, one of the students down the hall from me had a poster I'll never forget. It was a cartoon of the sky exploding, and the caption was, "He ain't coming back as a carpenter." Oh, Christian, are you ready? Are you ready to meet the risen Christ? He's not a frontiersman any longer. He's the king. And if you can see him through this revelation, you're going to feel the need to bow. And I guarantee you, you will never live in fear again. Not even of Satan. Today begins a study that will take us another maybe 8 weeks. And that means we are going to fly through the images. And I warn you now, we're just not going to have time to address most of the details. Because you see, we're going to look at each scene of the tapestry. And we're going to look at what that scene tells us. What's the main message? What's the story here? And then we can go back for the details. You can do that on your own. I don't have the wisdom of Solomon to give you. I'll give you what I've got, okay? But what I'm looking forward to is verse 3. That's what I'm looking forward to. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy. And blessed are those who hear it and take it to heart, what is written in it. Oh, because the time, dear John, the time is near. The time, dear Christian, the time is now.